Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart, and for the last 40 years, I've interviewed thousands of veterans.
Oh, give it a rest. You're under new management. It's Pete and Gary's Military History Podcast now. Hello, and welcome to Pete and Gary's Military History. And today's podcast, we're going to continue the story about Albert Ball, Pete. We're doing a lot about balls, and I don't know if you remember the lottery, Pete. They used to, because they talk about balls, and they used to have Mystic Meg, and I want a sort of similar moniker. And I thought perhaps some Gastric Gaz.
Gastric Gaz, that's fabulous. Yeah. And it reflects your inner working so well.
It does. So what are we doing today, Pete? We're talking about Albert Ball again. We've done one podcast on him recently, and this is following that up, isn't it?
It is, because he first came to prominence, as you will remember, although as it was a couple of weeks ago, perhaps not, in the air battles over the Somme in the summer of 1916. I'd say he was impossibly brave. He'd got his own method of aerial fighting that we talked about. No one seemed to be able to emulate it. What he'd do is he'd fly his Newport 17 straight into a giant German formation. It sounds unbelievable, but it appears to be true. Split them up, then pounce on the weakest and most isolated and stupid looking. So what I would call the Gary of the formation. And then he'd dive underneath his prey, pull his Lewis back up on his top wing and riddle his victim from below. The classic balls up.
Yeah, I remember all of that, Pete. Thanks for reminding me. Now, during that, he was suffering a bit, wasn't he? He'd asked for leave rather pointedly of his superiors, and he was turned down in the first occasion. But he had actually been home for some time, hadn't he?
Yeah, he'd been sent home. He was showing signs of combat fatigue. He'd had a brief period back home being... Well, fated's sort of the wrong word in some ways, because the British didn't really make heroes of their aviation aces, because there was this fear of what would happen if they were shot down, and also more of a recognition of, and I think we'll make this point now, I know you insist on us making this point, that although the aces and the scout pilots get all the publicity, the real work, the killing work, is actually done by the photographic reconnaissance pilots and the artillery observation people. They're the ones that kill their numbers in their hundreds and thousands. The aces have always been the icing on the cake. Nevertheless, that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about one of the greatest, Captain Albert Ball, DSO and Bar, when he went back. He's the hero of the entire Royal Flying Corps, and he's returning to active service in early April 1917, commanding a flight of 56 Squadron. Now, you might want to tell us a bit about what they're flying. What are they flying?
Well, at this point, Pete, they're equipped with the SE-5 Scout. That's not the SE-5A, Pete. That's a common mistake people make. It's the SE-5.
Ah, ooh.
And once more, it's a really imaginative name for an aircraft. And it was one more vital piece in the jigsaw of new aircraft that would take the RFC into the final 2 years of the war. It was a strongly built single-seater biplane. Ah, now this is interesting, Pete. It was primarily armed with a Vickers machine gun fitted with a Constantinesco interrupter gear. But it also still carried a Lewis gun, which was mounted on the top wing. Now, the Hispano-Suzo engine could generate, listen to this, Pete, 114 miles per hour at 10,000 feet. And that gave the SE-5 an effective ceiling of around 17,000 feet.
Blimey, that's a promising sounding aircraft. Now, we'll come back to this aircraft because, funnily enough, and again, your experience in contracts and governance and the rest of it, you'll know that when you get something new, there's often teething problems, and we're going to come on to that. But it would be a great part of aeroplane, and alongside the French Spad and the Sopwith Camel and the RE8 and other Bristol Fighter, this would be, as you said, this is what's going to take over.
But it's not just the aircraft that are special about 56 Squadron, is it, Pete?
No, it isn't. It's not at all. They come to be seen as a sort of elite formation of scout pilots, almost like and they're actually sometimes called the anti-Richtofen Flying Circus Squadron. I'm not sure that's true, but that was their reputation.
I'm not even sure if Richtofen had an auntie.
He did have an auntie. He had lots of aunties. And he was... It ended up de facto an elite formation of scout pilots that were selected by the squadron leader, who was Major Richard Blomfield. And they were either proven aces or people who'd showed a lot of promise in their flying training schools. Now, what did Ball think of the SE-5 when he first got it, do you think, Gary?
Well, interestingly, he thought it was totally unsuited to his unique method of fighting. The SE-5 was an aircraft that was built for power. It had the ability to zoom down, fire, and rapidly climb away, and that was the key to its performance. Whereas Ball favoured the manoeuvrability and the fast turning of the Nieuport, and he wasn't shy of putting his point forward.
What did he say? What did he say, Gary?
Well, this is a quote. We're going to share the Albert Ball quotes today. I nearly said Alan Ball. The Albert Ball quotes today, Pete.
I hope you're not going to annoy our listeners by reading it in a squeaky Portsmouth and England midfielder accent.
No. So this is Captain Albert Ball of 56 Squadron, and he says, "They've put me on a blank, 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 blank machine."
What could that mean?
I think he means a shit machine, Pete.
Oh, right.
But I should
not bastard then. I suppose it's got more letters. Bastard,
it's got more. This has only got 4 stars, Pete.
Oh, well.
"They've put me on a blank, blank, blank machine, but I should like to get back to my old machine as soon as possible. Oh, I shall never be able to do my job. I must fly another machine and then I shall get along with the job."
Now, he's not alone in harbouring initial doubts about the SE-5. It's got a lot of minor faults. And it's the sort of thing that really piss you off if you're trying to fly an aeroplane in action. And there's these little problems. They don't understand how the aeroplane can get to the front with obvious design flaws. There's all sorts of things. The telescopy thing, I'm very technical minded, but so I'm simplifying enormously for you here, Gary. The telescopy thing was wrong. They had a big metal plate under the seat to protect their arses from fire from below, and that was heavy and slowed them down, so they were easier to hit. There's all sorts of bloody things wrong with them. But Ball, although he thought it was a shit aircraft, he had the sense to do his best to overcome them. And this is equipment officer. Each squadron had an officer, sort of, you know, an engineer officer. And this is Lieutenant Hubert Charles of 56 Squadron. He says this: "Albert Ball finally decided that the SE-5 was such a bad aeroplane that it would be quite unsafe to fly over the lines. He got General Trenchard to let him have a 110 Le Rhone Nieuport again. He and I spent many hours at night trying to work out how to make the SE-5 work. He was a very unusual combination of a fighter pilot with a real interest in aeroplanes. The majority of them didn't have aeroplane knowledge, but he definitely had. Between the two of us, we finally cooked up the SE-5 so that it really worked. General Trenchard approved finally, and all our other aeroplanes were altered to the same design that we'd evolved and improved on Albert Ball's machine." And there were a lot of changes. A lot of the trivial, but something like moving that plate were crucial to the performance of the machine. And performance is important in action. Speed is important. This sort of thing. And it becomes, in my view, the most effective British scout of the war. And idiots will always say, "Hey, it's up with Cannell." But the top with Cannell wasn't. The great aces loved the SE Focus, could dive down and you could, from out of clouds or the sun, and kill before you knew they were there. It sort of releases a great warplane, doesn't it? How do you think Ball? Well, we've said Ball was a bit nervy and not. By the way, I make it clear he wasn't afraid, but he was a bit on edge, a bit nervous, wanted a rest, got exhausted, and he'd been sent back home. How did he feel about coming back into the fight, Gary?
Well, he's itching to get back into harness, as he describes it. And I've got another quote here from him, Pete. And he says, "Five of my best pals were done in yesterday, and I think it's so rotten. We have not got our machines ready yet, but when we do, oh, I do hope we shall let them have it." So that means he's like, you know, five of his friends are either dead or missing.
Yeah. Now, Monday, 23rd of April, remember that the Battle of Arras had started on, I think it was the 9th of April. My memory is not my best feature, is it? It was the 9th of April. And now the SE5 scouts are considered ready. So they tend to be called the SE5A now. And that's what most people would call SE5A. What a name to conjure with. As you said, Gary, it just you must stay awake at night thinking about that name.
At this time, you know, Captain Albert Ball, the leading ace of the RFC's, ready. And he's already flown several patrols in his personal Newport Scout, which he was permitted to fly on solo patrols. And this was entirely due to his unique status as the premier ace of the RFC. Now, Bald made his first flight.
Hang on. So that means that Joe Bloggs couldn't say,
No.
Besides my SE5A, I'll have one of them as well, please.
Now,
this is a special.
It's special. He's granted special permission to do so. I mean, but if those of you that have listened to the first podcast will remember that whenever Ball was engaged in action, he would come back and his aircraft would be riddled. You know, there'd be damage to all sorts of parts of his plane. So, you know, he probably needed more than one of them. Now, he comes back and makes his first flight back on the 14th of April. And he's clearly intent on feeling his way back into the saddle after his 6-month layoff. That's quite a layoff for a pilot, Pete.
It is. And things do change on the Western Front in that time. About 6 months.
It's about 6 months, yeah, absolutely. So this is Captain Albert Ball, 56 Squadron, and he says, "I had my first two flights this morning. In the first one, the Hun ran off, but in the second, I managed to get a few rounds in and made him run. In a few days, we shall start real work, and then I hope to have tons of sport."
Now, the SE5, it's important that the Royal Flying Corps have been going through bloody April there. Airplanes have been shot down. They had no effective response. And the advent of the SE5 is really important because it's the first great single-seater scout of 1917 to arrive at the front. The Sopwith scout was fairly useless. The Sopwith Camel had been delayed. That's still a month or two away. So this is important because the infantry are attacking on the ground. And if you look back at that date, 23rd of April, that's the time of a great attack on the ground when they had to cover the French for the failure of the French offensive in the middle of April. So this is important. Now, this is a quote from Ball. He says this: "I'm so fagged tonight, but feel like I must send you a line. We did our first two real jobs today, and I got two Huns. One I crashed, and the other I set on fire. I had six fights altogether. One of the Huns I got with a Newport, and one with a SE5. My machines were very badly hit about, and I'm having new planes tonight. Well, now I'm on the job at 5 a.m, so I simply must sleep." Gary, what does he mean? He means dawn patrol, doesn't he?
He does. Now, it's interesting. He himself is making comment about how badly hit about he is. We've made this comment. To a certain degree, it's just luck. You know, his aircraft's getting hit all the time. It could be his petrol tank. It could be him that's struck. But, you know, it's incredible luck.
Is his combat method, just flying at a formation, is that appropriate to the sort of formation fighting that, and the crowded skies? There's loads more aeroplanes in the sky. Is it appropriate?
No, I mean, he's taking enormous risks, Pete. And it's not unusual, as he himself is saying, for his aircraft to suffer considerable damage as a direct consequence. It's not just light damage in some occasions. He's talking about four or five planes being changed. You know, this is severe damage.
Well, here's a quote from him again. I had three fights, sorry, I do apologise, and managed to bring one down, crashed in a road. This I did with my Newport. After coming down, I had to have five new planes, for the Hun had got about 15 shots through my spars. Well, next I went up in my SE-5 and had a very poo-poo time. Five shots in my right strut, four in the planes, and two just behind my head. This was done by five Albatross scouts, but I got one of them and set it on fire at 14,000 feet. Poor old chap inside. I should simply hate to be set on fire. How would you feel about being set on fire, Gary?
Yeah, I think I should simply hate it too, Pete. Now, soon he's back in harness. In 1917, dogfights between increasing numbers of aircraft had become far more common. But to Albert Ball, superior numbers, just like a red bag to the proverbial ball.
A red bag.
It's like a red rag, but it's shaped like a bag.
It must be really infuriating to the average bull.
It must be. Anyway, I'm going to be Ball again now, and Captain Albert Ball says this. I was attacked by 20 last night and had to fire all my ammunition, getting two of them. It was dark when I returned, and everyone thought that I must have been done in, but I had to stop on their side until it was dark, for I could not fight my way through without ammunition. My right plane was hit a few times, and I had to have a new one. I have now got another two Huns, making four this time, and my total is 34. Only three more to be got before I'm top of England and France again. In order to whack the German man, he means Bulker, I'd love to get about 10 more. If it's God's will that I should do it, then I will come home. Oh, I do so hope it can be managed. Tonight, if it clears up, I'm taking all my flight out for a real good smack. I'm off in my Newport, then at 5:30 I come back and do a job on SE-5 with my flight. You see, they do one or two jobs each day and I lead them. But during the remainder of the day, I go up in my Newport and have a try myself. This is the only way to get them. Just keep at them all day.
Oh, that's his real love, isn't it? The solo flights. He's still a lone wolf, isn't he?
He is, Gary? But he's doing his duty as a flight leader. But it's clear that he loves those solo patrols. Absolutely clear.
Now, he said that means he spends more. That would mean he spent more time in the air than anyone.
He's up there more than anyone, yeah. And of course, he's at more risk as a result.
And this is recording officer, that's sort of like the adjutant sort of thingy, Lieutenant Thomas Marson of the 56th Squadron. He says he preferred to patrol alone rather than to lead his flight on patrol. He wanted always to be in the air. During flying weather, he was up and out by 5 o'clock in the morning and completely exhausted by his efforts, would be in bed and asleep by 6 o'clock in the evening. A bit of kid to yourself.
Absolutely, but without all the work in between.
In letters, he start. One thing he notes, what do you notice about the letters we've read together and we've noticed? What does he start doing?
Well, he's starting to get obsessed with the score and he's calculating his kills. So total Huns now 34, two more to beat the Frenchman. So he's in his own mind, he's in competition.
It's a bit obsessive, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in all probability, Pete, he hadn't really recovered from the combat fatigue that had forced him back to England in October 1916.
Yeah, he keeps adding up his victory. Do you think it's like competition? It's like, well, like Premier League goal scoring leagues. And do you think that's what it is? It's just...
Yeah, he becomes obsessed, it would appear, with beating the scores of other aces, and in particular, the French ace, Capitaine Georges Guynemer.
And you mentioned Bulker. We mentioned Bulker before. Bulker, of course, was dead, so he wasn't going to shoot any more down, was he? How many had Guynemer got? I can't say that.
He'd got 36 victories, and it became a great motivation for Ball to beat him. It's part of what drove him on to take ever greater risks.
Well. It's all quite exciting. Now, below them, the battles are going on. And they're coming through. They're coming towards Bullock, or they're coming towards the end. I mean, the Battle of Arras has degenerated into just a slogging match, trying to distract attention from the mutinying French army. And what's also happening is from early May, they're also starting to switch to Flanders, where they're planning what would become the Third Ypres. 56th Squadron, however, stay on that front, don't they, on the Arras front. Now, do you know what? How would you describe what Ball's doing at the first week of May?
Well, it's Ball's building up into a frenzy. You'd almost describe it, Pete, as a spiral of violence, and that's only going to have one logical end.
It is. It's the end game. So this is a quote from him, and just listen to this, Gary. At about 7:30, I sighted four red albatross scouts between Douai and the lines going south. Red, that's probably Richtofen and some of his squadron. I dived on the nearest red HA, hostile aircraft. This is from a report, so that's why it's formal. But scout. But four or five HA scouts were coming down on my tail. So I turned steeply and pulled down Lewis gun. Nearest HA fired at and overshot me. And I put in a good burst of 50 Vickers gun rounds into HA. I then fastened onto the tail of HA and followed it down to 2,000 feet, riddling HA meanwhile. HA dived into earth in the rough ground between Halte and Vitry. I then turned and climbed and joined the scrimmage, which was now taking place between a number of double-seater HA and HA scouts and Sopwith scouts, Bristol fighters and FEs. I was circling and manoeuvring for position and got onto the tail of a white HA scout with a pointed nose and put in a good burst of Vickers. HA dived steeply and cleared. The melee gradually made towards Douai, HA being outmanoeuvred and yielding ground. I went south to Cambrai and over Sailly viewed a white two-seater albatross. I dived down on HA and put in good bursts of Vickers and a drum of Lewis from 100 to 25 yards range. HA hurtled down, but owing to the dusk, the time now being 8:10 p.m, his ultimate end could not be observed. I climbed, picked up SE5A 4854 and returned home. Notice it's SE5A by this time. Wow, he's still relying on luck a lot, isn't he?
He is. But even he's got to realise that his good fortune's not inexhaustible. Now, his fellow pilots eyed him with a mixture of respect and amazement. And one 19-year-old was awestruck to find himself posted to the same squadron as his hero. And this is Second Lieutenant Roger Chaworth Muster of 56th Squadron. And he says, Captain Ball is surpassing his previous efforts and has already accounted for about six Huns off his own bat. He came back the other day with a huge hole right through the tail of the machine. The shell had carried away all his elevator controls except one strand of wire with which he managed to get the machine down. He got out and immediately got into another machine and was off again. He really is a marvel. He always comes back with his machine absolutely riddled with bullets.
Now, the point we emphasise again is that's not the best way. The best way is the Richtofen, the Manet way, which is to kill without risk. The Boelcke way, the Boelcke dicta, that's the future of aviation, scout fighting. Now, you've got another quote from Lieutenant Reginald Hodge, and this is 56 Squadron. I know he was a bit of a toff in some ways, the son of the Lord Mayor of Nottingham, a wealthy business, but he seems to have been a nice, quiet lad, doesn't he? Well, tell us what Hodge says. I don't know how you pronounce his name.
He was the quietest young kid you ever saw. The most inoffensive youngster, you'd think he wouldn't punch anybody on the nose if he could duck him. But when he got into the air, he was all hair and teeth. He was an excellent shot. He spent a great deal of time on the ground test firing his guns in the pits. Now, during lockdown, Pete, I've become all hair and...
Well, you seem to have entirely new teeth and your hair is going places I would never have imagined.
Oh, dear.
Now, 5th of May, it's we're moving into May. Ball crosses the lines with his patrol. He's in SE5, I think. And he finds himself again, either by accident or design, separated from the rest of his flight. So tell us what happens this time. It's quite a story again.
Yeah, once again, this is Captain Albert Ball. Crossing the line, I travelled northeast at 8,000 feet and viewed 2HA coming from the direction of Douai towards Carvin at 9,000 feet. I made towards Carvin in order to climb, HA following. I climbed to 11,000 feet, and by this time the nearest HA had got on my tail at a distance of 200 yards. I did a quick turn and got underneath HA, the other HA being then about quarter of a mile away. I pulled the Lewis gun down and fired two drums at a very short range. HA made no attempt to get away. I fired another drum, but HA by this time had got away. I followed and got on HA's tail and fired quick bursts from Vickers and Lewis guns at very short range, and HA went down out of control. By this time, the other HA had started firing. I climbed again, keeping away from HA, and manoeuvred for a chance to get on HA's tail. This chance never came, for HA came nose on at me, firing two guns. I opened fire with Vickers' gun and kept the trigger pressed, using one in one tracers, which could easily be seen going right into HA, until the machines came almost into each other. My SE5 was hitting the engine and I was covered in oil. I climbed and engine kept up revolutions, but I lost all oil pressure. No other HA came along and I went down to about 3,000 feet. Both HAs were lying on the ground within 400 yards of each other, completely wrecked. I then went back towards the lines and met two other HA near Lens. Having only very few rounds of Vickers left and not being able to see through sights for oil, I put my nose well down and made for home. Although the engine got very little oil under no pressure, it ran for 3/4 of an hour and got home okay.
Now, that's his report, but this is... from what I can gather of what you've just said, he ended up in a game of chicken flying straight towards another plane. Straight towards him. It's like those games, whose nerve will give way first. Now, we have another account that sort of refers to this, because that's those words, you read that in a pretty cool manner, and of course that's from a report. It's just quite flat, isn't it? But this is the state Ball was in, and this is the recording officer again, Thomas Marson of 56 Grunner. On his return to the aeroplane, his engine was found to have been shot through, and there were several bullets through the back of the pilot's seat. Flushed in face, his eyes brilliant, his hair blown and dishevelled, crikey, he came to the squadron office to make his report, but for a long time was in so overwrought a state that dictation was an impossibility to him. God is very good to me. God must have me in his keeping. I was certain that he meant to ram me. The possibility that his opponent, finding himself mortally hit, had determined to have a life for a life occurred to him. In that event, his nerve failed him at the last. Ball did not flinch, but in nervous exhaustion, he paid the price. And that's the obverse, the other side of that the account you just read.
At this point, he's displaying many of the classic signs of severe combat fatigue, Pete, isn't he? In truth, he's not yet recovered from the damage inflicted on his nervous system in consequence of his, let's face it, heroic efforts on the Somme. Now, that same night, he writes home to his girlfriend, and once more, you're going to be Captain Albert Ball.
I am. When I'm happy, I dig in the garden and sing. I don't get as much time off, but what I get is enjoyed. Oh, won't it be nice when all this beastly killing is over, and we could just enjoy ourselves and not hurt anyone. I hate this game, but it's the only thing one must do just now. And it's just all this hoping for a time after the war, after all the killing. It's quite sad, really. Note the date, of course. That was the 5th of May.
Yeah, now, there can't be any rest at Arras, Pete. The next day, he's back up in the hostile skies, and this time he's flying his Newport Scout because the SE5 was undergoing much-needed and extensive repairs.
This is
what we were saying earlier, Pete. You can't keep doing this.
Well, he goes up on the 6th of May, and once again he's separated from the rest of the patrol. The Nieuport couldn't keep up with a faster SC-5. So that's interesting in itself, if you see what I mean. And by this time, by the way, Ball is starting to appreciate the SC-5. Anyway, this is what he says. I went on towards Douai and viewed four red Albatross scouts, new type, going towards Cambrai at 10,000 feet. My Nieuport being at 11,000 feet. I got above HA and dived on the nearest one, getting in the centre of the formation of HAs, which broke up. I got underneath the nearest HA and at close range fired 2.5 drums of 1-in-1 tracer, which was seen to enter the HA. You'll hear he's using the same balls-up technique that we talked about earlier. The HA went down and was seen to crash on the ground near the crossroads and railway south of Sancor. The remainder of the HA kept well away and did not attack me until on my way home. I easily outclimbed HA and also could easily outmanoeuvre them, HA being very slow on turns. I could not fight again, owing to having no ammunition. HA only got 3 hits on my Nieuport. 3 bullets into the Nieuport.
Only 3.
Yeah. Now, what do you think should have happened at this point?
Well, there is an argument, isn't there, that he should have been sent home at this point. But, you know, after all, he's an experienced scout pilot and his task was to fly and fight. That's what he was there to do.
They need him, don't they?
They need him, and he was certainly more than willing. You know, he's trapped on this treadmill of competing victory scores, and there's absolutely little doubt that he would have resented being sent home before he had his chance to beat his French competitor, Captain Georges Guynemer, and rule the roost once.
Rule the roost, yeah, that's right. And here's another quote, just a short quote from that. I've got 10 more Huns, and my total is now 40, 2 in front of my French rival. Oh, I'm having a topping time. Notice the mood swings. Today or tomorrow, I'm being presented to Sir Douglas Haig. I'm very pleased. I just want to get a few more Huns if I can. Just a few more. Nah. On the night of 6th of May, he sent a last letter home. And again, he's referring to Ball. He says, I made my 42nd Hun yesterday, so I'm now 4 in front of the Frenchman. Constant competitive instincts in view. Do you think he's really not... I don't know. He's a product of the Somme skies, not
Earth
skies.
There is an argument that the increasingly sophisticated scout tactics of 1917 had largely passed him by. His technique was still largely dependent on his own amazing personal skill in close combat.
And luck,
yeah. And in a sense, Albert Ball's the antithesis of Richthofen, isn't he? You know, he's a lone wolf. He adopts that method of fighting, and it can't easily, and we've said this before, be passed on to a new generation of pilots.
Well, I know you love your cricket, but I've always described it. You can watch a well-executed cover drive and you can think, wow, that's beautiful. But can you do it? Can you do it, Gary? Can you do a well-executed cover drive?
No, I hate cricket and I have no idea what you're talking about. But I think the point you're making, the tactics suit Ball and they suit Ball alone. That's it.
Yeah, if you're under concentrated fire of multiple Spandau machine guns, you're taking big risk and nobody's lucky all the time. Nobody is. Fateful evening, Monday, 7th of May. That date, why do I know that date? What? See, he was born on the 10th of January. That was my birthday, yeah. Yes. What's 7th of May? Why does that sing out to me? What happens on the 7th of May?
That's my birthday, Pete.
So, like, my day is a day of joy to everyone and Ball's born, and your day is a symbol of death, despair and misery.
Well, you could put it like that.
I just did. Anyway, a call came through to the headquarters of the wing ordering a strong patrol because there's a new Jasta circus about and they want to meet them head on. So 10 SE-5As of 56 Squadron combined with 6 SPADs, that's a French, it's a very good airplane, a bit like the SE-5 in some ways, to sweep over Douai and Cambrai. And Albert Ball, he's leading A flight and that's with Lieutenant G. Maxwell and Lieutenant K.J. Nags. That's a good name, Nags. And they're going at a height of 7,000 feet, while Captain Henry Meintjes led C flight. That's Lieutenant Reginald Hoyge and Lieutenant... Know this name, Rog? Rog? Who's Rog? Gary. Cecil Lewis. Do you know that name?
Yeah, and actually, that's one of the only names you've been able to say correctly in that sentence.
Yes, it is. It is. And in the layer above them, at 9,000 feet, Captain William Crowe's got B flight. And that's your friend that you read the quote from, Lieutenant Roger Chaworth Musters. Lieutenant Arthur Rhys-David, do you remember him?
Yeah, I remember him.
Lieutenant John Leach. And they're still higher at 10,000 feet. What's happening is the British are now, they're not flying, they're going up as squadrons and flying at different heights, layered. They lose cohesion because it's cloudy. And this is a quote from Captain William Crowe. Now, you remember he's at 10,000 feet. And he says this. He's 56 squadron. What does Crowe say, Gary?
Three flights led by Ball, Mientjes and myself left the ground at about 5:45 p.m. with the express purpose of engaging the Richthofen Circus if they were in the air. The weather was very bad. Layers of thick banks of clouds hit the sky, and they ranged from 2,000 feet to 10,000 feet with varying sized gaps. We crossed the line south of Arras between the layers of clouds at 4,000 feet, and Ball, who was leading, shortly after led the formation into a large bank of clouds, which resulted in the various members of the formation losing contact with one another. I found myself alone when I got into clear space again, but some distance on my right I could see a number of SE-5s flying in very loose formation. I made for them, but a cloud bank enveloped me on the way and I lost them.
Now, this is something that's happening. They're at different levels. There's cloud over the place, so they get glimpses of people at different heights, and everything's sort of in trouble. Now, the German response isn't long in coming. They didn't have one mass formation. They too were in different flights, and they're also searching out the British. One of them is Lieutenant Wilhelm Almenroder, and he's the brother of the German ace, Lieutenant Karl Almenroder. And this is what Wilhelm Almenroder says. Suddenly there came an alert. Some enemy planes had crossed the lines. Four of us took off immediately. Lothar von Richthofen, that's Richthofen's brother and a very good ace on his own account, led our little formation. I flew to his left and a little to the rear. Flew to his right and to the rear. And either Esser or Simon was last. We were flying patrol from south to north over the trenches at a height of about 2,000 metres, and I was searching for enemy fighters to the west, looking up and down. So you've got scattered British flights up, you've got isolated German formations. So all over the sky, there's different groups of aircraft clashing, unclashing, and it's not clear what happened then or now. And the contemporary accounts are seriously muddled and laced with inconsistencies. Now, Second Lieutenant William Crowe was one of the last to see Ball. And this is the account that he gave, Gary.
Now, we called him captain previously because he's leading the flight. Yeah. So that may well have been his rank.
But
he was leading the flight, wasn't he?
Now, yeah, he was.
As it got darker and darker, I decided to return to our lines, and on the way I saw a solitary SE-5 flying due north a few miles over the lines and firing very lights. I immediately proceeded in its direction in an endeavour to join it, and getting close I saw it was Ball. He did not appear to see me, for he flew straight into a cloud bank in a northeasterly direction. I followed him. When I got out of the clouds again, I saw Ball diving after an enemy aeroplane which disappeared into a cloud and which was hotly pursued by Ball. I followed through the same cloud, which was a big one, and when I got through to the opening on the other side, I could neither see Ball nor his opponent, and I did not see him again. The height was then 4,000 feet.
Now, Ball was... It appears he was in combat with the Albatross D3 of Lothar von Richthofen. And Wilhelm Almenroder was somewhere nearby. Although Crowe and Lewis, Cecil Lewis was nearby as well. Neither of these saw Almenroder. They only saw Lothar von Richthofen. And this is what Wilhelm Almenroder says. I looked round and then saw, about 20 metres below me, Lothar in a wild circling dogfight with a British fighter. Both opponents circled round below me, but neither had a chance to shoot. As I was higher, I would have had a chance to fire. I would have had a chance to fire, but I had a feeling that I had better not interfere. Beside this, I could not understand where the other aircraft had gone, and I was afraid that they might return. So there's a lot of confusion going on here. Now, Crowe's trying his best to catch up with Ball, as we heard in Crowe's speech. But he's got something else on his mind. What's that?
Yeah, by this point, the SE-5's been in the air for nearly 3 hours, so they're going to be running very short of fuel. And William Crowe says this: "As I knew that my patrol must be running low, sorry,
petrol.
I knew that my petrol must be running low, I reluctantly made for our lines, unaccompanied, as Lewis and I had lost one another in the clouds. On the way back, I met a two-seater going home and had a quick crack at it without any apparent luck. I eventually had to land, owing to the darkness, at number 8 Naval Squadron, or Shell, at 8:15. When my petrol tank was examined, it was found to be almost dry."
Now, if one SE-5's petrol tank is almost dry, then you'd thought that Ball's SE-5 would also be running short at this time. Would that be the case, Gary?
Yeah, and if he's gone any further east, he's got to be at severe risk of running out of petrol by this stage. Now, Almenroder claimed to be holding the ring and still watching the contest between the two great aces.
And well, they are both great aces, yeah.
And this is what he says, Pete. Off you go.
Each tried to... I'll try and read it. My reading is appalling today. I do apologise, but there you go. Each tried to better his position by wide left turns. However, no one gained an advantage and not a shot was fired. Meanwhile, it was becoming darker and darker. Off to the northeast, Dwyer was barely visible. The sun had just gone down. Suddenly, as if both had received an order, the two left the circle and flew straight away. Lothar to the south, his opponent to the north. I believe that they wanted to stop the fight because of the darkness, but then both turned and rushed at each other as if they intended to ram. Lothar dipped under the other, and then both turned and rushed again at each other, only a few shots being fired. At the third frontal attack, Lothar came from the south and his opponent came from the north. I waited. The machine guns peppered again. This time, Lothar's opponent did not give way, give way sideways, but dived down to the ground. I had wanted to see where the plane crashed, but I became anxious because Lothar also went down in a rather steep turn and disappeared in the mist. I flew back to our airfield in order that a search be made for Lothar. As I jumped out of the plane, it was almost night. I was immediately informed that Lothar had made an emergency landing because his engine was hit. He himself was not injured. Now, what you think? There are elements of this account that do not meet with the facts.
No, I mean, there's no reliable accounts of the last combat between Albert Ball and Lothar von Richthofen. And though it's known that someone's bullets had caused sufficient engine damage to Richthofen's Albatross to force him to make a false landing that evening.
So in one sense, Ball shot, if it was Ball as well, there is an element. But whoever it was, and it was almost certainly Ball, had actually shot Richthofen down.
Yeah.
That does seem likely. But there is another truth, because Ball, what happens to Ball?
Well, whatever happened, he himself crash-landed near a farmhouse on the outskirts of a little village called Anwellyn, which you've allowed me to say, given the amount of mistakes that have been made today. So thanks, Pete. Now, Ball is fatally injured, and he actually dies a few minutes later whilst being cradled in the comforting arms of a young French woman who was the first to find him. So the British hero, the idol of the RFC, was dead. And do you know how old he was, Pete?
No, not offhand, not with my maths, no.
20 years old.
Oh dear, it's quite sad, isn't it? Now, so there's different views of what happened. The official German version of his death is he's shot down by Lothar von Richthofen. But there's problems with this, because he puts in a claim for shooting down what?
He puts in a claim for shooting down a triplane, which, you know, he put about the right time, but that doesn't make any sense, because the very fact that the confirming witness also claims it's a triplane only adds to suspicion that it's opportunistic, Pete, because the SE-5 is clearly...
It's not a triplane.
No, it's a biplane, and let's face it, Lothar von Richthofen's an experienced pilot. He'd have seen the difference in a nanosecond.
He would. The Germans don't have any hesitation in proclaiming Ball as the 20th victory of Lothar von Richthofen. Why?
Well, it's a great propaganda coup, isn't it? He's the great British ace, and he's shot down by a Richthofen.
Yeah. So, are the British completely honest about the loss of Ball? Are they paragons of truth and virtue?
No, I mean, they're not really sure what's going on at all. And at one point, there's a rumour that he'd survived and had been taken prisoner. So, they decreed that Ball must have been shot down by anti-aircraft fire, probably directed from the local church tower.
Is that true?
No, the evidence for any such claim is equally shallow as the German version of events.
And you're being polite there, because equally shallow means it's not true.
It's nonsense.
Nonsense. Now, there was an eyewitness, though, and this is quite interesting, a Lieutenant Franz Haller. He's with a group of other German officers, and he sees an SE-5 emerge upside down from a large cloud with its engine stopped and trailing a thin plume of smoke. And he
spoke. It'd be cruel to laugh at you.
Still upside down, he sees it crash near the Fashoda farmhouse, a mile from where was that place?
Anwien.
Oh, yeah. And he rushes over to find Ball had been removed from the wreckage and, as reported, being cradled in the arms of a Frenchwoman. Blimey. And this is what Franz Haller says.
Now, it's worth pointing out, this Franz Haller's German army, he's not in the air, is he? He's on the ground. And he says, the aircraft was upside down with the wheels sticking up. It was leaving a cloud of black smoke, and this, I considered, was caused by oil leaking into the cylinders. We examined the wreckage, and we all came to the conclusion that the aircraft had not been either shot down in an air fight or anti-aircraft fire, as the dead pilot had no marks or scratches and had not been wounded. I looked through his papers and found it was Captain Ball. We called him the English Richthofen. We were very disturbed by it all. I took his dead body to the field hospital. The doctor couldn't find any bullet wounds on the body, although the back and one leg were broken.
Now, I'm going to say this. He hasn't read the German memo, has he?
No, he hasn't.
To use a business term, you'd be... I mean, he's not online with the German accounts here at all. Now, let's talk about... What is it about the death of these great aces that... I mean, it's like the death of some medieval saint sometimes, isn't it? The stories that circle around.
I mean, it's slightly Arthurian, isn't it? I mean, the propaganda requirements of the time demanded that one of the new paladins of the air couldn't simply be defeated in combat. Oh no! You know, when their time came, they had to embody, you know, the whole spirit of the nation's manhood. You couldn't allow them to simply have been beaten.
So the British, he sort of flies into a sort of huge, ominous thundercloud, and possibly he will emerge to save us from a future threat.
Yeah, and it's natural that the opposing side are not going to forgo the chance to gloat about the triumph over an enemy ace. Of course they're going to gloat. You know, the endless claims and counterclaims are often deliberately intended to obfuscate and the often prosaic truth and propagate the image that's desired.
Now, so that it all gets a bit wreathed in legend. But I'm actually with Lieutenant Franz Haller, because he's seen the crash, he's seen the body, and he takes a fairly commonsensical approach. So go on, what does he think?
Yes, so Lieutenant Franz Haller says this. My own opinion, and you will appreciate I was not in the air at the time, covers just two possibilities. One, the odd chance that Lothar von Richthofen, in exchanging shots with Captain Ball's SE-5, hit the aircraft with a stray shot. The breech of the Vickers gun carried a bullet hole. Or two, I have thought that Captain Ball, flying into a cloud, turned the aircraft over and was unaware of this until he broke cloud. Then so low that he could do nothing, and the aircraft flew into the ground. Again, when the SE-5 crashed, it did not fire, and he must have been very low on fuel. It means it didn't explode, catch fire.
This is all interesting, because we know from... Remember when we talked about the death of James McCudden? there was a problem with the early production model carburettors that were fitted to the SC5 engine. They would flood if they were upside down, causing the engine to choke. Now, if the engine chokes and you're accidentally or otherwise upside down at a few hundred feet, what's going to happen?
Well, if you're very low, then, you know, in this case, Paul would, he'd have had absolutely no chance of preventing the SC5 ploughing into the ground.
Which is what happened to McCudden.
Yeah, and if you think about the injuries that Ball had, that's sort of consistent with that, isn't it? A broken back and a broken leg.
It sounds like it. So we're not saying anything for definite, but he was dead. He wasn't going to come back and help us against another... in the Second World War or anything like that. He was definitely dead. And it is a sad blow to him. What do you think's his greatest sort of thing that he leaves to people, to the Royal Flying Corps and later the RAF? What is it that inspires him? Is it his tactics or what is it?
Well, no, we've mentioned that he couldn't train others to do what he did, but what he could is you know, his sheer elan, as the French would call it, would inspire most of his contemporaries. You know, the bravery would be an example to everybody that followed.
Just sheer courage and guts and determination and no odds are too... This idea of no odds are too great. Fantastic stuff. Is it officially recognised,
yeah, I mean,
his courage?
A month after his death, on the 3rd of June, in fact, Albert Ball was awarded a posthumous Victoria Cross. Now, this is interesting, Pete, because the final score, which had mattered so much to him and arguably, in effect, had lured him to his death, was in the region of 40 victories.
Yeah, we talked last time about how it's difficult to be exact about these kills, victories, or whatever you like. But 40, around 40, is what he's generally assessed with. How was he dealt with by the Germans?
Well, the Germans, they give him full respect. He's buried with full military honours as a respected opponent. And I believe he was buried at and within.
I think he's in a cemetery. I'm not sure. I've never visited his grave. I know there's a marker where he fell as well.
Might be good to visit once we can.
Yeah. So overall, how do you feel about Albert Ball?
Well, the most telling thing for me, Pete, was his age. 20 years old. 20 years old. He probably wasn't old enough to shave. Well, he probably wasn't. You know, he'd lived a life in those few years that most of us would not live in twice as long, and constantly on the edge of death. And we mentioned on numerous occasions about how luck played its part. And, I'd remember the bit you spoke earlier about where he was saying God favoured him. And he must have felt like that. You know, he must have thought that he was somehow protected when every time he landed, his aircraft's riddled and he's fine.
But it all came to an end on that May Day. So, I'd forgotten the date.
Yeah. 7th of May.
I'll have to save up for your present. All right, Gary. Well, I don't feel too much like joking at the end of that.
No.
Poor old Albert.
That was very moving, Peter. I thought you read it beautifully.
Bastard. Thank you very much, Gary. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, Pete.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?